Sociologists over the decades have charted social change here in the U.S. through a survey. We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There's this long-standing social science survey that's taken the pulse on our social and cultural views since the early 70s. About a decade ago, the survey started including questions on sexual identity, and there are new trend lines to report. An increasing number of women are identifying as bisexual, but men, not so much. What do you think this says about the nature of human sexuality? Are you bisexual but don't feel like our culture fully accepts you and your identity? Why is that? Join in this discussion at 800-642-1234. Paula England is a sociology professor at New York University, where she focuses on sexual behavior, gender, and labor markets. Paula, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So every couple of years, this general social survey comes out. It's this data mapping of social changes, lots of data for you to look at. And one of the most recent ones saw this increase in the number of women who report they're bisexual. You've seen a similar change in your research. What do you find?
Yeah, the recent study showed in younger women, 8% were saying they're bisexual. I did a study using a different survey, also of the whole nation, and for women born between 1985 and 1995, 7% said they're bisexual. And an even higher percent say they've at least had one same-sex sexual partner. 20% said they were attracted sexually to both men and women. And these are, you know, these are big upticks from what was true before. So something's going on.
What might that something be? What do you make of these upticks?
Well, one idea I have goes like this. You know, we've had what we sometimes call the gender revolution, meaning, you know, women's roles have changed so much, say, in the last 40 years or something. You know, more women are employed, women are in jobs that used to be only for men, you know, women are athletes, women are clergy, they're in the military. So there's been a lot of opening up of what roles are seen as okay for women. And so you could see this as just kind of a part of that. It's always been seen to be gay or to be lesbian, to be bisexual, to have a same-sex partner as not conforming to gender norms. And in a sense, all the change that's happened has given women more permission not to always be conforming to traditional gender norms. And this might be just part of that.
So there could be this opening right now for more acceptance?
Yes.
What do you find for the men you looked at? Is the number of men who identify as bisexual higher among the younger generations?
The research that I've done and that others have done from this survey you mentioned sees some increase in men having had a same-sex partner, but doesn't see an increase in men identifying as bisexual or an increase in men identifying as gay, as far as I've seen. So it really looks like this trend is happening in women much more so than in men. And that's kind of interesting. And I think one reason for that is I think, you know, men and women that are not completely heterosexual may encounter what we sometimes call homophobia or, you know, bias against them. Attitudes about this have changed a lot. You know, like the attitudes towards same-sex marriage being okay have changed dramatically, the same survey shows. But in general, things where men are not conforming to a traditional gender norm, which says, you know, you're heterosexual and you're fully employed, you know, and you aren't the main person doing housework and childcare and all those kind of norms, and you're tough rather than vulnerable. Those norms about men have changed a lot less than for women. And I think that may be a big reason why we haven't seen as much change in men. biases against it are just so much greater.
We're talking about the latest in social science research on sexual identity. Paula England is with us. She is a sociology professor at NYU, where she focuses on sexual behavior and gender. With more women identifying as bisexual, what do you think this says about the nature of human sexuality? How have your feelings about your own sexual identity changed over time, maybe even decades, from young person to adulthood? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Paula, in the context of your research and researchers like you, sociologists like you, what do you mean when we say bisexual? Is this person who has had sex with both genders, or are there other stipulations?
Well, one of the interesting things about asking people's identity on a survey is that the survey question doesn't say, here's our definition of bisexual, right? It just asks people, you know, do you consider yourself gay, lesbian, bisexual, heterosexual? I think those are the options that we're given. They've experimented with giving some other options. But so it's a matter of what it means to the person, right? I can tell you that in the data, there are more than twice as many women who say they have ever had a same-sex partner and have also had a male partner. That's 20%. Only 7% identify as bisexual. So, you know, I think based on qualitative research, a lot of times what people mean by it is, I'm attracted to both sexes. I'm open to having a relationship with either sex.
Even with increased acceptance, as you mentioned, of gay and lesbian relationships, is there still a stigma out there to bisexuality? What does that look like?
Well, I think there still is a stigma against, to some extent, against anybody in the LGBT community. You just had a news story right before we came into the show about that. But I think that there's also an extra stigma that may be faced by bisexual people, which is sometimes they may feel that they don't fit, you know, they have some bias against them in the straight community, but there's also some bias against them in the gay community. Now, the umbrella kind of movement of LGBT or LGBTQIA, whatever, has tried to, you know, create some solidarity between these groups, and that's often successful. But still, people report that they sometimes, you know, find bias in both communities.
From an academic perspective, do you see that there is more research going on in bisexuality than before over the decades?
Yes, and one reason for that is that among women, this isn't true among men, but more women are reporting that they identify as bisexual than report they identify as lesbian. And actually, that has been true for quite a while. It's not, you know, just something in the last 5 years. So, you know, if this is a phenomenon that's as large and actually a little bit larger than people identifying as lesbian, then it needs to be studied.
Looking at the ways that cultural expectations have changed as women explore their sexual identity and what this means for human sexuality in a broader sense, Paula England is a sociology professor at New York University. Are you someone who didn't previously consider yourself attracted to the same sex, but that changed as you grew older? What have you noticed? Why do you think that happened? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. Talking about sexual identity and why the percentage of women reported that they're bisexual has spiked over the past decade. One of the takeaways is that young people today are willing to explore their sexuality. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Have you noticed a big shift in the way people accept those who don't identify as straight? Men, Do you feel there are additional barriers in the way of your gender, having the freedom to explore your sexuality? Why is that? There's time for your thoughts at 800-642-1234. And New York University sociologist Paula England is our guide on this. She researches sexual behavior and gender. Paula, if the increases that we see in bisexual women is because we're more accepting, perhaps, of doing things men would normally do, we're seeing more acceptance in our society, what does this tell us about the way we value things that women would normally do, like, you know, be with a man?
Right. Well, you know, that's a really interesting question because before I got into researching on sexuality, what I was studying was the sex gap in pay. And one of the things that I learned studying this is that in the workplace, the more the work you're doing is seen as a traditionally female job, the less it gets paid. You know, sort of after we, you know, adjust for like how much education does it require and things like that. Mm-hmm. So in other words, men and women in traditionally female jobs, say requiring a high school degree, get paid less than men and women in traditionally male jobs that requires a high school degree, and the same for a college degree, et cetera. And so to me, that does show some that the culture devalues whatever is feminine as seen as feminine. And you know, so all these changes that we've seen are sort of, yeah, women can do more masculine things because we always respected that stuff more anyhow. We just didn't let women into the club, right? Mm-hmm. And that's changed, and women are allowed to do more of that. I mean, they still face some barriers, but I think the devaluation of things seen as feminine kind of is still there in a lot of ways, in the workplace. And you could say that because men engaging in same-sex behavior is seen culturally as less masculine, that, you know, again, that's part of why there's so much bias against it. And that it's of one piece with the, you know, devaluation of jobs seen as more female.
Paula, let's look at pornography for a moment and how we've seen this making its way into our cultural norms. Do we see this devaluation of the feminine in the types of porn that has become so popular?
You know, I don't know if I would call it devaluation of the feminine, but what I would say about pornography is that in the main, it focuses on what's pleasurable for men, but it makes it look like whatever's pleasurable for men, women are just dying for too. But one thing that's relevant to, you know, bisexuality, some people have asked me the question, well, in pornography consumed by men a lot, it's seen as sexy to have some, you know, woman-on-woman sexual action, right? And so might the acceptability of this, of women having female partners, be partly just because, well, men think it's titillating to watch? You know, I think there is something to that, and that may explain part of why we see, you know, heterosexual women kissing women on the dance floor at parties and things like that. It's more for men's titillation. But I think that most women who are calling themselves bisexual, you know, are really interested in a private sexual relationship with a woman, not just titillating men. One piece of evidence for that is in this other survey that I did some research on, most women who say they've had sex with a woman have had oral sex with a woman, for example, you know, not just kissing or something like that.
What do you think this all says, you know, stepping back about the nature of human sexuality as a whole? Will we continue to see quite a bit of uptick and changes as you look at this data mapping as it goes on, you know, decades from now?
Well, it's hard to predict the future, mm-hmm. but I might expect continued increases. I think what it really tells us is that sexuality is very malleable by culture, by, you know, social circumstances. Because obviously, if exactly how we were, you know, who we're attracted to and who we have sex with was 100% hardwired, then we wouldn't see change over time. You know,
right.
It's not like the gene pool of our nation has changed that much. Now, on the other hand, that does not mean that sexuality and who you're attracted to is 100% socially determined either. I think it's a mix of, you know, some people may be biologically hardwired to be attracted only to same-sex partners, some only to other sex partners, some may be, it could be open either way in terms of their biological wiring, but if the culture sort of, you grow up and the culture says, hey, the default option is everybody's heterosexual, then if that works fine for you, you may never question it.
Mm.
But then if there is more cultural acceptance, then some people who do feel the attraction may act on it, and the very attraction itself may be sometimes affected by social ideas about, you know, what's appropriate or what would be normal. So I think you know, both biology and social things are in play here, but the fact that it's changing is telling you that something about the social situation is changing and making this more, you know, more inviting for more women.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about sexual identity and recent trends with New York University sociologist Paula England, and she studies sexual behavior and gender in her work. Paula, while we've just touched briefly on the gender revolution, the gay rights movement, making it easier for women to identify themselves as bisexual, what obstacles do you see that are still out there as we look at our society?
Well, here's a mundane one. Same-sex relationships between women run up, in terms of a long-term partnership, run up against the sex gap in pay, because instead of having, you know, either a man and a woman or two men, you have two women, and women tend to earn less than men. So that in itself may be a barrier to long-term same-sex relationships between women.
Is that budging at all?
The sex gap in pay?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it continues to narrow, but much more slowly. The big progress on that was really in the 80s, and since then it's narrowed, but very slowly. You know, it's still a big factor.
What might the Me Too movement have had in that pay gap movement, if anything at all? Has there been any research on parallels there?
You know, that's a really interesting question, you know, and I really don't know. I will say that I think the relevance of the Me Too movement, you know, which is mostly about having there be some negative consequences for men who essentially sexually harass women in the workplace, that's partly about taking women's sexual agency seriously, which includes the right to not want to have sex with someone and not be sexually harassed by them. And it's kind of a piece with the same thing if we take women's sexual agency seriously enough to think that they may choose women partners, and also that in heterosexual relationships, women's pleasure is taken more seriously than it has been in the past.
So there's a lot to watch here as a sociologist. Where do you think the research focus should be as we wrap up here?
Well, all sorts of things need to be studied. You know, I think that we need to, I would say a real focus is look at how this plays out over the life cycle. Is this something, for example, these women identifying as bisexual, fast forward to when they're 50, do most of them end up married to men? Do they end up married to men, but if they broke up, they might get a women partner the next time? You know, those are things we need to study.
Paula, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Paula England is a professor of sociology at New York University. Coming up, a mandate by the federal government involving small refineries continues to frustrate the oil industry. Meanwhile, exemptions to the federal rule are concerning to the biofuels industry and corn farmers here in the Midwest. We'll break it down, learn the latest on ethanol policy after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're at the intersection of ethanol policy and special interests. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. President Trump has repeatedly told farmers in the Midwest that he supports ethanol. Here he is in Council Bluffs, Iowa, last month.
As a candidate for president, I pledge to support our ethanol industry and to fight for the American farmer like no president has ever fought before. And we're winning these fights. And you're great patriots, I will tell you. We're winning these fights.
Earlier this month, the EPA released its annual rule for the level of ethanol that must be blended into our nation's gas supply. And the target disappointed the corn-based ethanol industry. Meanwhile, the president has ordered the EPA and the Agriculture Department to review their policy of allowing small oil refineries exemptions from federal obligations. And now we see competing ad wars over ethanol policy. Do you work in the oil industry? Have you seen the effects of policy moves like small refinery waivers? Or are they just a piece of the puzzle when it comes to how we regulate fuel? And corn growers, what's your take on the challenges in your industry? What do you need to grow? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Wally Tyner is an agricultural economics professor at Purdue University. Wally, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So last week we saw this National Trade Association for the Oil Industry put out an ad campaign asking President Trump to roll back these ethanol mandates. Help us understand what these mandates are, what they do.
Well, the mandate started back in 2007. Congress at that point decided that the market wouldn't produce as much renewable fuel as would be good for the country. And so they created mandates for different kinds, for ethanol, for biodiesel, and other biofuels. And it's always been a contentious issue. The oil industry, of course, wants to keep all of the fuel market. And the ethanol and biodiesel industries want to keep the share that was allocated to them in that bill. So there have been skirmishes over all kinds of issues. The current skirmish is over these small refinery waivers, as you indicated.
So within this policy, there is the small refinery exemption. How does that exemption work? What does that mean?
Well, any refinery, and small is sort of a funny name for it because Exxon, Marathon, any company can apply for this small refinery waiver, and it basically means that they do not have to comply with the renewable fuel standard, which is the name of the mandate. And what that means is that effectively it lowers the overall level of the national mandate for the renewable fuel standard. So by law, it's 15 billion gallons for ethanol, for example. Last year, the sum of all these small refinery waivers reduced that by almost 2 billion gallons. So it does reduce the level of the mandate, and it reduces the cost of compliance for those refineries that get the waivers, but it doesn't necessarily reduce the amount of ethanol sold. And that's an interesting point that hardly ever gets mentioned.
Why is that?
The reason is because Ethanol has changed its role in the fuel business. It started off as basically just a fuel extender, but ethanol contains a lot of oxygen, which helps fuels burn cleaner, and it contains a lot of octane. And so the refining business has switched to producing 84 octane, by and large, out of the refinery. They blend that with 10% ethanol, and that gives them 87 at the pump. So they need that ethanol to get the octane to sell the 87 at the pump. So today, the demand for ethanol is not coming from the renewable fuel standard. It's coming from the whole refinery supply chain. So the demand for ethanol hasn't fallen nearly as much. It's fallen slightly, but not nearly as much as the sum of these waivers, because the industry still needs it.
And basically, then, there are these concerns over these waivers. President Trump has ordered a review, and in a letter to the EPA administrator, a lawyer for small refinery companies has said that they'll sue if the EPA does not act on 38 pending requests for waivers. What about litigation here?
Oh, it's quite possible. Almost every issue that's come up regarding the renewable fuel standard since it came into effect in 2007 has gone to the courts ultimately. So it's quite likely that this also in some form or another will go to the courts.
We're talking about ethanol policy with Wally Tyner. He's an agricultural economics professor at Purdue. What do you think about the role of ethanol in our fuel supply? Do you work in the oil industry? Have you seen the effects of policy moves like small refinery waivers? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's take a call now. Chris is joining us from Marshfield. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, my comment is I left the agricultural industry about 20 years ago because of chronic low prices, and we're seeing that with all the dairy farmers leaving. My neighbor just sold off his herd, you know, and you know, it's a sad thing that we have a minimum wage, you know, but there's so many exceptions, and commodities are one of them. We should have reformed and gone to a minimum wage commodity system that adjusts with the CPI rather than, you know, just open market commodity prices. That would do better than subsidies. Subsidies are part of the problem because they prop up failing industries.
Chris, thanks. Wally, can you break that down for us? Minimum wage, commodity, and CPIs. What are we talking about here?
Well, a few years ago, we used to have minimum prices for corn and soybeans and other products. We used to have target prices and loan rates and the like. And so we used to have a system that did that. But by and large now, we've moved to a system of crop insurance where farmers can buy insurance for their crop. And it's been a big deal this year because a lot of farmers are going to get prevented planting insurance for either corn or soybeans. So the main support system for commodity farmers today is crop insurance, which, yes, it's not a minimum wage, but it is the mechanism that we use for those commodities to help farmers weather bad years like we're seeing this year.
Well, with ethanol, with our corn supplying 40% of our corn supply is going to ethanol. Is that, I mean, that's a big chunk going to the ethanol industry. Are we too reliant on that specific way to use the corn we grow?
Well, first of all, that number is a bit misleading because that's a gross number. For every bushel of corn that goes into an ethanol refinery, a third of it becomes ethanol, and a third of it becomes distillers' dried grains, which goes back to feed animals.
Ah.
So the net is really about 26% or something like that. Still a big number, but it's not 40%. So far, there were dire predictions back in 2008 when we had the drought and some of the earlier other years where we've had high corn prices that we couldn't do both food and fuel. More recently, the growth in yields, the growth in productive capacity. We have the most efficient agricultural system in the world in the United States. And it's pretty clear at the current levels that we can produce both food, feed, and fuel.
And where do we cap that growth on corn? Do we continue to grow the corn industry?
Well, the ethanol industry is capped right now. It's at 15 billion gallons. That's the level of the renewable fuel standard. It's not set to grow. That could change if Congress changes its mind, but that's where it is now. So the fuel part of it's not growing. The food and feed part is not growing too much either. The biggest flux or flex in the system is how much corn do we export? So we have enough corn for all of our own needs, food, feed, and fuel, plus we export corn to the rest of the world.
And how much do we export to the rest of the world? How big of a commodity is it for export?
You're testing my memory. I think it's
a ballpark. You know, it's early.
I think it's about a fifth of the corn.
Do you see farmers concerned about this push and pull in Congress over ethanol policy? At the end of the day, is this really going to hurt our corn growers here in Wisconsin?
Every year, somebody in Congress introduces a bill to get rid of the renewable fuel standard. And so, yes, it's sort of a constant struggle. You've got the oil industry, and the oil industry is particularly concerned about E15, that's what was in your opening statement from Trump. They're concerned about that because that does take market share. They don't need more than 10% to satisfy their needs for oxygen and octane. So that extra 5% takes market from the oil industry. So that will be the grounds for the next big fight, how far do we go with E15? My sense is that it will grow slowly, perhaps very slowly, because the system isn't set up for it yet. But I don't think the oil industry stations are going to be jumping on the bandwagon for E15. And so the growth in it is not going to be that large, and the oil industry will continue to be opposed to E15.
We're learning about ethanol policy and what happens to a new draft rule for ethanol targets for next year. Federal mandates require refineries to include increasing amounts of biofuels in the gasoline they produce. Wally Tyner researches the ethanol industry as an ag economics professor at Purdue University. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. When you think about the future of the oil industry and the biofuels industry, what changes do you want to see? Join in. You can call, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll be back in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at ethanol policy here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Earlier this month, the American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers, they launched ads urging President Trump to ease ethanol mandates for small oil refineries.
President Trump promised a win-win energy policy for all Americans. But for small refineries, unchecked ethanol mandates are job killers, hurting the backbone of our manufacturing economy.
And the corn growers say waivers are hurting family farms. The National Corn Growers Association launched this ad last month.
Mr. President, you delivered on E15, but we have more work to do. EPA's oil refinery waivers threaten to undo your good works.
President Trump is supporting farm families. His EPA should too.
Where do you come down on this? You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Wally Tyner stays with us. He's an agricultural economics professor at Purdue. So, Wally, let's talk about these ads and the pushback against these waivers. Where are these ads coming from, and what are they trying to accomplish?
Great question, Kate. The ads, of course, are coming from the industry associations on the corn and ethanol industry on the one side and the oil industry on the other side. The ethanol industry is concerned that effectively what these waivers do is reduce the level of the renewable fuel standard. And long run, they don't want that to happen. They want to keep the standard at 15 billion gallons. That's what Congress legislated. The oil industry is mainly what are called merchant refiners. Merchant refiners are refiners that don't have any gas stations. They don't sell any product at retail. They just buy crude oil, refine it, and then sell the gasoline and diesel and jet fuel to other people. But still, they're obliged to comply with the renewable fuel standard. So they view that compliance cost as a real cost to them and think they shouldn't have to pay it. And it's, some of them are small, some of them are large. So it's really about the way the renewable fuel standard is enforced. It's enforced on domestic refiners and importers of oil products. And so they want to get rid of that cost, basically.
Stephanie in Hazelhurst called in to ask, when we consider the economic impact of ethanol on various industries, do we also take into account the amount of oil that's being used to produce it, like, you know, by farm equipment or transporting the commodity? What goes into that calculation?
Great question. And it's been early on, there were legitimate questions about how much emissions are reduced on net for corn ethanol. But the recent work has shown that corn ethanol does reduce emissions, and that's after you take out all of the fertilizer, all of the diesel, all of the transport, all of the energy that goes into producing it is netted out, and it still reduces greenhouse gas emissions around 25% to 30%. So yes, it all is counted, and corn ethanol does reduce emissions. Biodiesel reduces them even more, so all of that is counted.
Well, farmers do have a vested interest in what is going on in Capitol Hill in these ethanol mandates. How much have ethanol mandates helped farmers?
Another good question. Before the mandate ever happened, we were producing in the early 80s and even into the 90s about 4 billion gallons of ethanol through a subsidy. But then in 2007, the mandate passed, and most people think, well, the mandate's what drove production from 4 billion gallons up to 12 or 13 billion gallons. But in fact, what happened is that oil prices shot up during that period. Gasoline prices between 2004 and 2008 multiplied 4.5 times. We had in 2006 a ban on something called MTBE that was used as an additive for gasoline because it was toxic and it was getting into the water supply. So all these things came together, and most of the growth in ethanol during that period was market driven. Mm. The market was always ahead of the renewable fuel standard. And that's something that most people don't recognize, is that, you know, had that not happened, yeah, the renewable fuel standard would have been really important during that period. But those things did happen. And so it was a market pull rather than a mandate pull during that period. Later on, the growth has been more mandate.
Well, the petrochemical industry is a very profitable, large industry with a lot of ability to push its special interests. Are these mandates even making any type of impact on the bottom line of these companies, of these oil refineries?
Well, in fact, today they're helping because they need the octane in ethanol. And ethanol is the cheapest source of the octane to blend with gasoline to get it up to the point that you can buy it at the pump and it'll work in your car correctly. So right now, the system has been geared since about 2009, 2010, to using ethanol as a fuel additive to provide that extra octane, to provide that extra oxygen. So since that's the cheapest source of getting that octane, the refiners are actually benefiting from it.
What is the cycle of ethanol targets and rules? Is this a cyclical thing yearly, or does it change? How often, you know, does Congress perhaps change its approach, and even the president change its approach on these ethanol targets?
The target for corn ethanol is 15 billion gallons, and it's been that for several years now, and okay. It's not set to change at all. So it's constant. The target that changes is something called cellulosic biofuels. And that's always been the dream, and the hope is that we can produce biofuels from corn stover. We can produce it from crops that we grow, switchgrass and miscanthus, even municipal solid waste. But we haven't been able to do that economically. And so each year, even though the mandate grows, each year EPA has to waive that mandate because we can't produce it anywhere close to economic.
Do you mean by broadening out the value added industry here, making more crops being able to be changed and used in this capacity?
Well, that, but mainly it's using, you know, you can take off about half the corn stover, the corn residue, without affecting soil fertility. You can use municipal solid waste. You can use wheat straw. There are a lot of things that we're not using today that we could use if we had a cost-effective way to convert it to biofuel. What's missing and what never happened was development of that cost-effective way to convert it.
Well, beyond the waivers, what are the next steps that you're watching for in this ethanol industry tug of war? What is the biofuels industry working toward, and what about ethanol here?
I think one of the important developments that's emerging is aviation biofuels. You don't think about that very much, but you know, on the ground, if you want to reduce emissions, you can use electric vehicles. You can use compressed natural gas vehicles. In the air, if you want to reduce emissions, there's only one choice, and that's biofuels. Because you can't use batteries. They're too heavy. You can't use compressed natural gas. It's not have enough energy density. So there's a lot of interest now in getting biofuels that can be used in aviation. And I see that as perhaps the next biggest push in the biofuels arena.
Wally, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Wally Tyner is an agricultural economics professor at Purdue University. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.